Welcome to Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. My name is Clayton Platt, and I'll be your host for this podcast journey. Now, for many people, practicing mindfulness has very little to do with sitting on a cushion, lighting incense, or even focusing on their breath, just paying attention to what they're doing at any moment. And doing this intentionally can create that same magic. Our time together is intended to share how mindfulness plays out in everyday life for our guests. Now, before we begin, here's a word from our sponsor, Meditation for Leadership. We all feel it. The pressure to keep up, to perform, to push through. But lasting success doesn't come from speeding up. It comes from slowing down, leaning in, and creating the space to lead from within. That space is where we shift from autopilot to intention, building mindful habits that strengthen focus and calm. It's where we stay connected to our values and purpose, choosing to respond instead of react. It's where we unlock our potential to positively shape our own lives and empower others to grow and thrive. That's the work of Meditation for Leadership. If you're ready to create the space for sustainable success, visit meditationforleadership.org. Well, welcome to Magic in the Moment, Mindfulness in Real Time. I'm your host, Clayton Platt. And today we're going to be exploring ways in which mindfulness isn't just something that you discover sitting on a couch, but rather something that really comes alive in our everyday lives and how we deal with people, our jobs, and the world. And my guest today is Elizabeth McKenzie, who's a researcher whose work has focused on the real-world impact of mindfulness. She did a 2020 study in which she co-authored, and with her colleagues, they looked at how mindfulness supports not just individual well-being through resilience, self-regulation, and stress reduction, but also how it shapes the quality of our relationships and deepening empathy, communication, and connection. I invited Liz here because her research, in my estimation, and I think you'll agree, beautifully aligns with our theme, mindfulness in real time. And we're going to talk about what her studies have revealed, how mindfulness shows up in the body, not just the mind, and why even small, consistent practices can transform how we show up for ourselves and for each other. So Liz, I'm so glad to have you here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Clayton.
Elizabeth, I'm really interested, and we talked a lot in the past, sort of getting ourselves set for today, but I'd love it if you could just give me a sense of what drew you to mindfulness and mind-body practices in the beginning.
Well, in the beginning, I was drawn first to yoga when I was in graduate school, for all the same reasons that other people seek these things out. I myself was stressed, and I found a yoga teacher named Joan White, who was teaching at Penn at that time. And it was pretty transformational for me. And then I spent a period of time studying Qigong, which was also very helpful to me in a number of ways, and eventually found my way to a regular sitting meditation practice. So that was my personal journey. And all these things have been helpful to me in a number of ways.
Hmm. So I was thinking back that, you know, you and I talked about how you had this sort of early in your career, so to speak, a big picture focus, and you were looking at things that were very abstract and sort of societal influences, and looking at, I think we talked about maybe healing society, if that doesn't make, you know, isn't.
Yeah,
right. And but you found your way to supporting individuals. And I I was really fascinated, Liz, how that sort of evolved. And I would love to kind of hear if you would take us through that from the big picture to the individual. I think that's a real interesting journey.
Well, like a lot of people in academia, I wrote a dissertation that wasn't practical, I guess. I titled it Healing the Social Body. And so I was really interested in these very big picture ideas and so on. I'm not sure that any ideas in there could be easily applied, right? So I wasn't thinking that way. Then when I got into the classroom and I was teaching Penn students, undergrads, many of whom were pre-meds, I noticed that they were very, very stressed, really suffering, honestly. And so I thought, well, what can I do to help? And although I could introduce yoga in the classroom, that's harder for a number of reasons. So I decided to just open each class with a few minutes of meditation. And at first I used audio from well-established meditation teachers. And then eventually decided I wanted to become certified to teach mindfulness and started studying to do that. And eventually got certified by the Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adults, who back then were called Karoo Mindfulness. They've changed their name. And so that I could bring their curriculum into the classroom, basically. Mostly they're set up to have their curriculum taught as outside the classroom, as an extracurricular activity, right? Through student health or student life or something. But what I found in offering it as a freestanding 4-week course, even if it was free, because students are so busy, it kind of fell by the wayside and there were high attrition rates. So I thought, what if I just put it right into a 4-credit course? What if I take a 14-week, right, regular 4-credit course and embed the 4 weeks of this curriculum into it? And I've been experimenting with that ever since. And it seems to work pretty well. So, you know, not every student meditates every day. And I'm sure not every student continues to meditate after the semester is over, but it gives students an opportunity to establish a practice, and it plants a seed. So even if they don't start with a daily personal practice in college, they'll have that experience. And then if they ever do want to do that in the future, have another opportunity, they'll have that foundation. So I think that I think there's a lot of potential, and I've noticed recently more and more studies being done at other colleges and universities, looking at what happens when we integrate mindfulness into courses, like first year seminars, for example, or other kinds of electives. And I think it's got a good potential to help students in a number of different ways, and not just with their mental health, but also, as you alluded to before, with communication, even things like respectful dialogue, learning to cultivate altruism and compassion. So I'm kind of excited about that. And I'm excited to see that other people are this is kind of bubbling up in a number of places. And I think that it's a healthy thing.
Yeah. I was just equating, I think that idea of integrating the 4-week elements of mindfulness into a normal 14-week course and not making an either or, but it's something that they get credit for those weeks mm-hmm. that they're learning about mindfulness. There's a huge value in that. As you were saying, it's alluding, it's like they're busy and thought of like, I'm going to do something separate. It's like, ugh, pull your hair out. I'm thinking about in my life as a corporate training facilitator, there's a similarity there with weaving mindfulness principles into an existing sort of standard leadership course where it's not either or, it's like, oh, it's part of it, the fabric. And in fact, in so doing, you're just reinforcing all the good points that you want them to take in. And I also want to acknowledge that sense of It may not be change, you know, life-changing for someone to do that. They may not suddenly say, oh, I'm going to meditate every day. But you've opened a window, mm-hmm. and you've created a spark of curiosity that when it's needed, there's been an entree, mm-hmm. and done in a way that feels logical, feels real. And they saw it, quote unquote, in real time. So I really tip my hat to that. And I want to go back, if we could, if this is appropriate timing, to that study that you did in 2020, because that was really reinforcing some of the elements that I think you've seen come out in your teaching. You know, how would that be fair to say?
Yeah, well, there's two studies. The 2020 study was actually a qualitative study looking at mindfulness-based teacher training in K through 12 settings. And we relied heavily on the research of Tish Jennings, who's a leading researcher in that area, among others, just looking at what happens, what's the teacher, lived experience of teachers doing this kind of training? In what ways does it help them? And in what ways might it create what Tish Jennings and others call the pro-social classroom? So that was the idea of that. The article that just came out in 2025 was a qualitative study of students who had been taking my classes, basically. So it was led by a graduate student at Penn GSC, who's now at Cornell. And she she was the one who did the interviews and collected the data with the students, not me. And I worked with another graduate student to write it up. And basically what we were looking at, is it feasible? Does it work to insert a mindfulness curriculum into a 4-credit course? And then what do students get out of it? What is the lived experience of students? Right? What are the challenges? What seems to work? And then in the discussion, we did some speculating about ways in which integrating mindfulness into higher ed in this way could make higher ed more meaningful for students. So I think that's the crux of it is to me. I think we can help them manage their stress. In other words, make their college experience less stressful. But we may also be able to make it more meaningful. Mm. And because right now there is a tension in higher ed between, you know, getting a degree as a return on investment, which is a real thing, right? And people need to think about that. But could there also be an element of personal growth and, young people reflecting on their values, reflecting on ethical behavior, reflecting on how to align their actions with their values and so on. So there's this whole other piece of getting a degree, you know, being in college that isn't always, I think, fully explored. Mm-hmm. And I think that mindfulness has the opportunity to help students reflect on things like the kind of lives they want to lead and what does it mean to be an ethical actor in the world and what does compassionate leadership look like and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, so I really embrace this. And I was just thinking about as we look at mindfulness, the sense of people are often drawn to it, and certainly media espouses the sense of stress management and mm-hmm. being able to deal with anxiety and stress as some of the principal reasons to practice mindfulness. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I want to kind of circle back to that use of mindfulness to do that inner journey of sort of contemplating who you are and what's your role in life, and understanding that simply asking those questions and reflecting and sort of quietly sitting for insights doesn't mean the answer pops up immediately, and multiple, you know, insights surely will arise, and there'll also be a lot of noise. But understanding the ability to be aware of what's noise and what may be coming from society, the messages from family and society, versus what's coming from your heart. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is useful and beneficial throughout your entire life. But learning that early, to me, just provides a foundation for personal growth, which is when we see it in others, and I've seen it a few times, I go, whoa. But when it's missing, we go, oh, and I look back at my own personal journey and it wasn't like that, right? And I chose a major for the purposes of practicality. Mm-hmm. And looking back, oh, would I do things differently? Yes. But along the way, I stumbled into learning to sit and reflect. And in its own time, it's had that beneficial effect to me to say, okay, and connect with the why. So I love that. There's getting a job, having a career. Those are very important things. The ROI of your astronomical cost of education, higher education, yes. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the return on your personal investment can be huge.
Yeah. And things like, I've had students, for example, in the class write their term papers on things like mindfulness in relationship or in family dynamics and how that can change parenting or, right, your marriage or communicating, you know, in your personal life. And it has a huge impact, right, on quality of life, right, as you establish those relationships in young adulthood and so on. So there's all of that. Also, I just wanted to bring up something I read recently. John Kabat-Zinn has spoken eloquently about all these things, but one sentence that I read recently, he talked about how he said something to the, and I'm paraphrasing here, when people can appreciate that awareness is at least as powerful as cognition.
Mm.
That things change. And that's so interesting to me because education, of course, has focused exclusively on cognition, right? Western education for many generations now, almost exclusively. And we're used to approaching everything with our cognitive minds, right? Cognitive problem solving and so on. But the way he put it, and as I thought about that, is it leaves out of the equation pure awareness, right? And that's actually a big part of being human. And I say all this because as I've pondered the implications of AI as it becomes more sophisticated and becomes applied in education and workplaces and everywhere else, apparently, including our personal lives, right? My understanding, anyway, is that AI cannot yet, anyway, be said to have awareness, mm-hmm. right? It has cognitive abilities. So these large language models, right, can think in that sense, right? But is that all that a human consciousness is? Is it just cognition? Or is there also awareness? And I think that mindfulness training could have the potential to help people cultivate the ability to become more aware and to cultivate a kind of presence that exists outside of or beyond cognition, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And it's devoutly to be wished, honestly, because I think that for me personally, that's a huge concept for me is awareness. And, you know, this podcast isn't about my personal journey per se, but I weave in personal examples because they're human. And I think my journey of almost 25 years of meditating if I can point to one thing that has been the greatest area of personal growth, is awareness. Mm-hmm. And not always when I need it most, which is before I make the mistake, before I hit the, you know, reply all, or, you know, say something in response to something that I should have taken some time to reflect on and calm down and be more, you know, equanimous about it. But I sometimes practice that awareness post facto, and that's still not a terrible thing. And I think it is reflected in the teachings of, as we sit noticing when we get distracted and when thoughts arise, that's not a terrible thing. That's actually what we're meditating to try to build and strengthen, is that awareness that our cognition is flipping around mm-hmm. and sometimes taking us into directions that aren't all that healthy. And if it's in a conversation, I've said the wrong thing, I can pause and make fun of myself and just say, I'm sorry about that. Let's try again. So I think awareness mm-hmm. in so many different ways, right?
And so some of that is metacognition, right? So yeah. being able to observe your own thought processes, right? And observe your own emotions also, right? So that ability to be an observing mind generates more awareness. Or think about it this way. There's a meditation teacher who wrote, we know that we're not just our thinking mind because we have thoughts we don't want to think. So who knows that? Mm. Right? Yes. So there's something in us, right, that is observing our cognition. And that is, I think that's really valuable. And most students aren't given that ability to, like, why do I think that? So this mm-hmm. thought pops into my head. Where is that coming from? How is that shaped? Right. Mm. And is that something I want to say right now? And students sometimes ask me, well, in your personal life, you know, how has meditation or mindfulness been most helpful to you? And I don't know if this is always true, but it makes me laugh sometimes. Sometimes it's really just been the things that I haven't said or haven't done. It's in refraining. Mm-hmm. And I think especially in parenting, right? So sometimes my mindfulness practice is most powerful when I'm able to pause and not say the thing that's burning on my tongue, right?
Yeah.
Not say the thing that maybe I was programmed by my parents to say in that situation, right? And to choose something different. And often that's just non-doing, not doing anything, which sounds like, oh, that's not powerful, but actually is.
Right. 100%.
Like what you were saying earlier, refraining from making mistakes can be a big part of how mindfulness helps us in the world.
Right. And then being gentle to ourselves when we've made the mistake, right?
Yes.
Avoiding what, I love the concept of the second arrow of suffering that the Buddha talked about. So the first arrow is whatever, you know, whatever is bumming you out. And the second arrow is beating yourself up because of that, the instance of making the mistake or the faux pas, right? And being gentle and self-compassionate and saying, yeah, you know what? Guess what? This is part of the human journey that I'm going to screw up. And if I can accept that and be gentle at the same time, what does that do? That also allows me to be much more accepting when I see other people screwing up. In my judgment, I think them screwing up is like trying to pull back from that judgment and just say, okay, look at them. Look at them being human, right?
Exactly. And so we have a whole section on self-compassion. I rely heavily on the work of Kristen Neff. Mm-hmm. And show her, I think it was a 2012 TED Talk, which I highly recommend everyone watch. And for a lot of Penn students, it's a big revelation because they've really pushed themselves, right? and they've arrived at this place and they don't know any other way, you know, other than to motivate themselves with harsh criticism. It doesn't occur to them that they can be soft with themselves. And the interesting thing is, once we, you know, and I am still on this journey, it's not like I've perfected this or anything, but what I've noticed is once when I'm able to be a little softer with myself, right, not only does it help me recover and get back on track faster and, you know, without wasting so much energy on beating myself up, right? When I'm softer with myself, I'm softer with others.
Yeah.
And speaking about healing society, I mean, that I think this cultivating self-compassion and compassion for others is a big piece of that. So, but it starts at home.
It does. It does. I mean, that's thinking about Jack Kornfield talks about that. If your journey towards compassion doesn't start internally, it ain't going to get there. You need to be authentic about going inward with self-love, self-compassion. And I think that that sense of being softer and gentle with ourselves and how that affects how we treat other people and see other people is huge. And I'm staying on campus, so to speak, with what happens in the current environment. Since October 7th, a year ago, right? And how the divide for how, you know, what side of a stance you're taking and your ability to be gentle enough and accessible enough and maybe have that strong back, soft front to allow you to, I've got convictions, I've got beliefs, I've got values. There's nothing wrong with that. There's everything right with that, but I'm going to have a soft front. And that self-compassion helps create that and support that and cultivate that so that I can be accessible to different points of view and hear them and not block them off with my presumptions and my biases. But let me hear what the person's really saying.
Yeah. I think self-compassion and compassion, mindfulness can really help cultivate tolerance. Tolerance for difference. Tolerance for different ways of thinking, different opinions, different ways of being.
Yeah, and I'm reminded frequently at how people with a certain mindset always felt themselves as the tolerant ones. And I'm not going to name names, but you know, there's a certain part of our society that has felt we sort of understand we're worried about our fellow man and we want to create tolerance. And yet we're not tolerant of people who don't think the way we think and wonder why that dialogue stops so quickly, which is not to say that at the heart of that differences of opinion don't exist. And again, having a sense of what's right and wrong, that's necessary, a sense of values. Mm-hmm. But in that, To preach tolerance in an intolerant way seems a little counterproductive.
You know, I was thinking back. This is a totally new thought. I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with this. But when you were asking me before about, you know, when I was doing my dissertation work, it was all abstract. It was all ideas, right? And so, you know, in a certain sense, I was attached to those ideas and derived some level of identity, right, from the ideas I held. But moving into actually applying mindfulness in the classroom, that didn't come from an idea for me. That came from witnessing the suffering of real human beings in front of me and mm-hmm. identifying with that. It's like recognizing my own suffering in that. And then just reaching out in that very kind of human way, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't driven by an idea at all, right? It was just an outreaching of care. And I think that That's what we need more, which reminds me of Bell Hooks, mm-hmm. who wrote really eloquently about creating an ethic. She called it a love ethic, or, you know, a society, a truly caring society. And I think that that's what we need most right now. And it doesn't have to be complicated or abstract.
Right.
It's just about caring for the people we encounter, honestly, on a daily basis. And yeah.
Yeah. And living into that, Liz, and living into that, it's because, again, we can, at an abstract level, hold on to that as a good thing, a belief. It's like, yeah, that's something I think we should have more of. But living into that is a little bit more difficult because, again, the way we're wired and the way society has sort of cultivated us, we are tribal and we have in-groups and out-groups and we feel safer in in-groups and we have a tendency to very quickly separate ourselves from the out-group and see danger there.
Absolutely. It's hard to feel loving when you feel threatened. Right.
Right.
And so that's a real thing. So one thing though, that having some kind of mindfulness practice can help with is having the self-awareness to recognize, right, when you feel threatened, mm-hmm. right? And try to understand, you know, how real is the threat right now? Obviously, if it's a real threat, you need to protect yourself. But often it's not a threat to our personal safety. It's a threat to our identity, right? Our ego identity. And can we have the self-awareness to feel those feelings when they arise and not act from that place of fear.
Yeah. And one of the things that I learned in a study of neuroscience, which I thought was really fascinating, is that the brain doesn't distinguish between physical threat and social threat. Mm-hmm. So the same parts of the brain, I'm speaking to someone who studied this, I know, but the same parts of the brain are activated whether someone is holding a pistol to your head or whether you have been criticized unfairly on Facebook. Now, not to the same degree necessarily, but it's the same part of the brain. And understanding that with awareness and being mindful of, wow, my reaction to something has been triggered and I'm now shutting down. My limbic system's gone, you know, fight or flight. And I'm no longer acting logically or rationally because my prefrontal cortex shuts down when my limbic system is going overdrive, right? Mm-hmm. But being able, as you say, to notice that, feel that, mm-hmm. because the feelings emanate from your body. Your body's sending those messages very quickly. And our ability to say, "Ooh, I recognize that. I've felt that before. And I can deal with this. I'm going to take some deep breaths," right?
With self-compassion.
Right, exactly.
Ouch, this hurts. As Kristen Neff would say, this is a moment of suffering.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's important, not just to be like, oh, I shouldn't feel this way. Or
right.
and that something has triggered this and I am suffering right now. And this is a moment of suffering. And I think, you know, what I remind myself and my students is, you know, mindfulness doesn't make any of this stuff go away, honestly, but it may give us an opportunity to behave in such a way that there's a better outcome.
Right. That's it.
Than if we hadn't had that awareness.
Yeah. It's that better outcome is something that we can connect to with our sort of internal GPS to say, this is in my life, I would like to steer this way. And there's going to be storms and I'm going to be pushed off course. But I'm going to first be kind to myself for going off course. and not beat myself up for being a terrible sailor. We can just follow this analogy, right? And then say, okay, now as I calm down, I can say, oh, this is the way the waves are moving. This is the way the wind is. Here is how I can course correct and get back to following my North Star. And that North Star provides us guidance for our future. But if we're beating ourselves up because we've gone off, we're not going to be able to get back on track, or at least not as quickly as we need to. So I love that. And I also think one of the things that Kristen Neff talks about with self-compassion is humanizing it, right? So it's being kind to ourselves, it's being mindful about this is what I'm feeling, and then recognizing everybody goes through this. Mm-hmm. I'm not alone.
The common humanity piece. Yeah, she defines self-compassion as self-kindness, mindfulness, and a sense of common humanity.
Yep.
And I think that we all need those three things so much.
Yeah, we do. We do. You know, I'm thinking one of the topics that you and I talked about previously that I want to make sure I don't miss, because it really resonated with me, was and you'd sent me some articles that Elon Geppner Dales had written, and his mm-hmm. work around his youth council. If you can kind of take me through a little bit of that, because I just think that work is so important, and I think it dovetails a lot with sort of what you're doing. It sort of speaks to a lot of your efforts in dealing with emerging adults.
Yeah. Well, I've invited him, Elon Geppner Dales, to come and speak to my class, actually. I have to figure out the Zoom tech, but I assume that's going to work out later this month. And he wrote an article that was published in Rolling Stone magazine recently that I thought was really compelling, talking about smartphone use and smartphone mm-hmm. addiction among students, emerging adults, you know, younger students, emerging adults, and adults. And the ways in which cultivating presence can help us cope with all that. And I thought it was such an interesting piece that I really want to dive into it more, because I think he's right. I think that he talks a lot about using breath awareness in his work. But it's essentially the form of contemplative practice, meditation, mindfulness, and bringing that awareness so that we're not, because I think what smartphones do, I'm just really brainstorming here, speaking off the cuff, because this is a newer area for me. But I think what they do is they kind of magnify the cognitive. So if we have two sides of us, two sides of human consciousness, say, and one is our cognition, right? And one is awareness, pure awareness or presence. I think what smartphones and the internet do is they interact with the cognition, right? So we pick up I notice this in myself. If I have a lot of heavy or difficult emotions that I don't want to deal with, I often will pick up my smartphone, you know, without conscious awareness. It happens, it just happens. And I'll start interacting with it, whether it's email or the news or social media or actually not on a lot of social media, but I'll start interacting with it because it stimulates that part of my brain. It's entertaining to my cognitive side, right? And so what smartphones have done is they have further cemented this addiction to thinking, if you will, and taken up all the room that we might otherwise have been just spending being aware, walking in nature, or being aware of our child, right, with whom we're speaking, or being aware of the weather. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, it does. So, I mean, being aware of our bodies,
our bodies. Exactly. Yeah. And so I think he's really onto something. And I think that you know, people don't want to appear to be Luddites. So everyone's embracing AI and everyone's embracing smartphones and all the other new technologies is coming down the pike, right? So, you know, this technology is here. It's not going away. But I do think we need some wisdom with how to integrate it into our personal lives, our workplaces, our classrooms, and so on. And I'm not sure that that's been sufficiently cultivated, I guess.
No,
and so I think that, you know, and again, I found the complete, on my smartphone, I will confess, but I did find the complete John Kabat-Zinn quote. I think it's worth repeating. When you begin to see that awareness is at least as powerful as cognition, then you can restore balance, at least in your own life and relationships, and perhaps in some small but not insignificant way in the larger world. So I thought that was really beautifully put, this idea that we're not throwing out thinking or cognitive skills, right? No one wants to do that. But it's finding this balance between awareness and cognition. And understanding that awareness is powerful. And I think as AI continues to become more sophisticated and more powerful, we're going to need an equally powerful awareness.
Yeah.
An equally powerful presence in order to apply these technologies in ways that are going to end up being good for humanity. So,
yeah.
That's my big idea around that. But I encourage people to read Geppner Dales's article. I think he hit the nail on the head in terms of screens in general and smartphone use in particular. I see it in, you know, teaching a freshman seminar now, not at Penn, somewhere else. And the students are really, really attached to their screens. And it can be very difficult for them to even make eye contact and talk with one another in a group. So I think that's, there's a role that contemplative practice can play in helping us, get a handle on how to use these technologies in a way that's going to end up being beneficial.
Yeah. And I was thinking about that with AI, and I'm just thinking in the space of a year, what has happened to our work life and our non-work life based on the ubiquitous nature of AI. And I tend to be someone who embraces aspects of it fairly strongly. And I think that key word that you've brought up around this about awareness is making sure that as I do that, what is being served? How is AI serving me? Is it replacing my creativity, or is it enhancing? Is it sometimes giving me, at my request, some ideas to do some research on, and then asking for further research? And is there anything wrong with that? Probably not. On the other hand, do I make sure that I keep my awareness active enough to say, can we fact check that? Right? Because I did a conversation with someone, and I had AI look into some things that this person had spoken publicly about. And I quoted that, and the person said, I never said that.
Oops.
And I went, oops. So that awareness of what am I using this for? And do I rely on it so substantially that I'm no longer actively involved in the cognition part of it, so to speak, right? And is it a tool that helps me? And if it is helping me, the awareness of, let's take a moment, how is this helping me? And sometimes I think it really is. Sometimes it has cleaned up some language. It's like, and I can be pretty verbose. So let's shorten it. Let's edit it down. That's very cool. Save me some time with some ideas. Give me some thoughts, some feedback, right? But as you've also said, it's not aware, right? It seems aware, but it's not, right?
And that's the thing. AI can seem like it has a personality. AI assistants, right, have that quality in communication sometimes. And that has drawn some people.
Let's pause for 1 second. I'm wondering. Pardon me for this, but we will get regrouped.
No worries.
There we go. I don't know whether I mentioned this to you, but I did a 1 hour interview with my niece, who is this world-renowned yoga teacher. She's Deepak Chopra's director of yoga for Chopra Enterprises.
What's her name?
Her name is Sarah Platt-Finger.
Huh.
Yeah, look her up. And actually, if you have a moment, you can check out our podcast. But
okay, I will. I'll do that.
The first time we did it, we finished and she said, you know, Brody was barking the entire time. He was downstairs. I know, I just mentioned her name. Sorry. And I didn't hear it. So we had to redo it. This way we can stop.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. We filter things out sometimes. Anyway, I'm not an AI expert, so I don't want to go far into that, but
no, I think we're fine. I think we're fine. We can, what we can do as we restart, because I think we've covered a lot of great stuff. I really appreciate it.
I'd like to just end with this. You know, I was thinking about how I ended the article and this idea that, you know, most mindfulness teachers talk about our interconnectedness. You know, that famous Thich Nhat Hanh quote, we are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness. And so I wrote that mindfulness could encourage an ethos of caring that extends beyond individual well-being, right? So that we're motivated to address not only our own suffering, but that of others. Mm.
I would love that. And I'd also, if it makes sense to you, I'd love to kind of say, and how would that show up in the classroom? You know, and I think, honestly, we think about students supporting each other and being kind to each other and giving grace to each other as opposed to feeling the need to always compete and, self, you know, compare.
Exactly. Exactly. And Penn, I mean, a lot of institutions are like this, but Penn is certainly like this, is hyper competitive.
Yeah.
Right. And these students trained to win, to compete and to win. And so it's a very different, hopefully, I mean, if things go well, I create an atmosphere where they don't have to do that, right?
Yeah.
In the classroom, and they can let their guard down and be more vulnerable and just interact with each other as, you know, humans.
Yeah. So let's restart and I will, I will sort of put a bow on our AI conversation and then circle back to sort of how mindfulness for you can show up in the classroom and you can take that quote and take it from there if that sounds good.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Okay, so I'm going to go back 3, 2, 1. So we can kind of come to that agreement about the benefits and worry about AI, and it's going to be with us. So keeping our awareness as this continues to grow as part of our lives, both at in the workplace and at home, and how we deal with others. Just, I think, a wise piece of caution. Just, it's a great tool, but our awareness can keep it in perspective. Yeah. So then I want to circle back, Liz, if we could, that the way that mindfulness shows up in the classroom for you, especially after students have gone through your integrated course, but how you can see it possibly showing up at its best, so to speak, as examples of when it is supporting individuals to be the best versions of themselves.
Well, I think one thing that happens is, so when I start the class with a 5-minute meditation, and then when we go into the mindfulness curriculum, we do, you know, much more than that. The bulk of the class is spent in mindfulness, and there's always room for check-ins. So, and people will talk about, oh, it was really hard for me. My mind wandered a lot. I couldn't stay focused or whatever. And it's really good for students to hear their peers say that. Because of course it is, you know, you can't just sit down and make your mind blank. Right? The mind actually generates all kinds of thoughts, right? Over a period of 5 to 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
So we can sort of put a kind of bow on this concept with AI, knowing that it's not going to go away. It's going to be an increasingly large part in our lives, and the way it influences the way we do work, the way we deal with society in general and culture. But being conscious and trying to keep our awareness on call, I think can really help us navigate these changes as we go forward in sort of the most appropriate way. It's not going to be easy, but we can. So, and then I wanted to circle back, to the evidence that you've seen of how mindfulness can show up in the classroom, sort of the benefits that accrue to teachers, professors, students, for being present, staying in the moment, or returning to the moment, and sort of the overall effect that this can have in the learning experience.
Well, I think that one thing, a couple of things. One is students sometimes express to me, oh, I really didn't think I'd be able to do it, but now 4 or 5 weeks in, I'm realizing, oh, I can sit in meditation. And 5 minutes or 10 minutes goes much faster than in the beginning. I hear that a lot. So in the beginning, 10 minutes felt excruciating, like a long time to just sit. And then by the end of the semester, it's like, oh yeah, it was easy. I can sit for 10 minutes. And I'm observing the thoughts that come in and letting them go. And I'm not beating myself up, right, for experiencing mind wandering. So that's beautiful when that happens. It's also, so they know now that they have this metacognition, and they're able to observe their own internal world, right? I think that's important. And they can focus better. So they have, that's a real skill that can be applied in many different ways. But the other thing that I think is valuable is when we do check-ins and students hear from other students, and me for that matter, about how difficult it is to meditate, and how much their mind wanders, and how it's hard to make the time, because it is. And they realize, oh, I'm not alone in that. And then they can begin to let their guard down a little. And these are students who've been competing at a really high level, really for their almost all of their lives, right? Certainly the last 10 of their lives to get into Penn, right? And succeed at Penn. It's a very, I would say, hyper-competitive environment. And so that really allows for a kind of connection and closeness. And I have the luxury of teaching small classes, and they're electives. People are choosing, right, to take this class. And so we get to know each other better than in some classes. And I think there's a real value in that. We're students being appreciated as whole people, right? By their peers and by me, and understanding it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to make mistakes. It's okay to not get something right away and not, you know, do it right. Do you know what I mean? So, because whatever arises in your experience is just what's happening. That's meditation. There's no right way or wrong way to meditate in that sense. Right. Mm. So you just embrace yourself exactly as you are. Nervous, calm, right? Clear-headed, full of crazy thoughts, right? Whatever it is that arises is okay. You embrace it all. And so that is a good antidote to the quote-unquote pen face, you know, this sense of I am a, you know, successful student. I have no vulnerabilities. I'm super competitive, you know, and I win, you know, that's right. You know, I achieve. So it provides an antidote to all that. And hopefully students will see that they can have this internal softness and self-awareness and achieve things in the world, right? And reach their goal. So it's not an either or. It's not like they have to abandon all of that in order to become more mindful. It's a both and.
Yeah. Ideally. It's a yes and, right? It's a yes and.
It's a yes and.
And I was thinking about it.
I'm vulnerable and flawed, and I can do these things.
Right. Right. That sense of multiple identities. We are not just one self. In fact, we can get into the conversation about self in another conversation, but we are a mosaic. Our being is a mosaic of all these different identities, and understanding that they all exist and it's fine. We're strong and we're weak, and we're, you know, creative and we're technical and we're, you know, we're growth mindset and fixed mindset. And I was thinking about this sense of the growth mindset and being willing to fail and being, you know, we don't want to fail a course, but we may want to allow ourselves to take courses that are difficult and we may not get, you know, and that's a huge thing.
And it just sparked a thought for me. You can't really be truly creative without taking risks. And if you're super afraid of failing, then you're not going to take those creative risks, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that that's important to think about, right? Yeah. And that creativity, really, no matter what we end up doing in life, right? Bringing in something new. Adding something new to the mix is a lovely thing. It's gratifying and it's helpful, and right, even if it's a small thing. And that takes creativity, and that takes a willingness to be open and to take at least some risk. So I think there's that. And I wish that higher education in general were more open to that and allowing students to feel safe enough to take risks. Because I think that that's a big piece of it. I also, you know, think that mindfulness in the classroom can help, at least I hope, help students think about getting back to this idea of Kristin Neff's definition of self-compassion, the third component being a sense of common humanity. So I try to emphasize that, you know, in my classes, because I do think that's what's going to help us heal a lot of the wounding that we are witnessing and experiencing now pretty much all the time. So, and that, you know, is taken right out of also bell hooks. I've been, you know, influenced by her book all about love. So we don't talk, we don't use the L word a whole lot. We don't talk about love, but I do think we need a kind of love ethic or a compassion ethic, if you will, where people are thinking, okay, I'm suffering. How do I address my own suffering? And in doing that, can I also address the suffering of others?
That is so important. And I think honestly, it's a wonderful way for us to have our conversation come to a close. I think it's a great message for us to reflect on going forward. And whether we're teaching or we're a student or we're facilitating training or we're just living our lives, having that opportunity to understand our common humanity, and know that what we're going through, other people are going through, and giving space for that is huge. Liz, I am incredibly grateful for our time together. Thank you so much. I am, I have mudita for your students. And for those who don't know that mudita is, the Buddhist term for, it is, sympathetic joy. And it's,
oh, beautiful.
It's not envy. It's not envy. It's like, I'm taking joy in the good fortune of others. So those who get to be in your classroom are fortunate, and I bow to their, you know, their graciousness in that and your teaching. And thank you for spending time with me. And I look forward to us staying personally connected. And actually one thing before I close, is there anything that we didn't cover today, that would be important for you to share?
Just that I feel incredibly lucky to be able to do this, and I do my best and am a flawed messenger for a excellent message. But, you know, I'd like to see more and more instructors and in all levels of education explore, you know, how to bring some of these practices into the classroom, because I think that they have a lot of potential to heal, basically, and heal our classrooms, heal the larger environment in which the classrooms are embedded. And I see it as a way to increase our level of compassionate awareness.
That's a wonderful, wonderful thought. So thank you for sharing that. And I want to see more people adopt that in the classroom and outside. So blessings to you, Liz. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
As always, I want to thank our guests today for sharing their stories, as well as my producer, Mary Ann Sanders, for all her work behind the scenes. And finally, for the support of my friends at Meditation for Leadership through their sponsorship. Until next time, this is Clayton Platt reminding you to look for those moments of magic in your life that lead to mindfulness in real time.